Hello and welcome to this episode of Nucleus Wealth in Power, where I, Shelley George, Head of Operations at Nucleus Wealth, go looking for what the good life is and how finance can support and empower us in achieving that. I'd like to start in the spirit of reconciliation by acknowledging the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and the connections to the land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. Today I'm joined by my colleagues Eileen Chong, Client Liaison Specialist, and Damien Klassen, Head of Investments, to go back to the basics of property investing. If you've ever listened to our Big Brother Nucleus Investment Insights shows on property, you might have been left scratching your head a bit on a few of the concepts that they take as assumed knowledge. I'm hoping today we can uncover some of those for you and help you engage some more with the world around you as a result. Before we get into it though, I'd like to introduce my guests a bit further. Eileen Chong has been Client Liaison Specialist at Nucleus Wealth for over 1.5 years now, working tirelessly to ensure clients and prospective clients get the answers and help they need. Eileen has a Bachelor of Environments majoring in Geography from the University of Melbourne and has been soaking up finance ever since she started working here. Welcome to the show, Eileen.
Thanks, Shelley.
And some of you may already know, Damien Klassen is one of the founders of Nucleus Wealth, and as Head of Investments, he's responsible for the construction and management of all the Nucleus Wealth investments. He's been working in investments since the mid-90s for the likes of Schroders, Wilson's HTM and Aegis Equities, and is an expert in financial modelling, having lectured in it for 12 years. Welcome to the show, Damien.
Thanks, Shelley.
All right, so for today's episode, as I said, we're going back to the basics in property investing. I got the inspiration for this episode from an article that was published in The Guardian this week. It's called Bubble or Boom: Why Ultra-Low Interest Rates Mean House Prices May Never Bust. Is by Martin Farah and features quotes from our very own Damien Klassen. We put the link up in the show notes for anyone who is interested in reading it. To briefly summarize the article, Farah is trying to determine a number of things. He's trying to determine if house price growth can be classified as being in a boom or a bubble, whether other countries might try to implement policies similar to New Zealand and potentially have central banks targeting house price growth as part of their interest rate setting strategies, and whether house prices will continue to rise. For me, reading it and then discussing it with you later, Eileen, there are a few key points that I felt needed to be clarified in order to really understand the arguments Farah was making, and I thought this podcast would be a perfect place to do that. So we've got a bit of agenda that we'll go through. We'll be looking at property market fundamentals, what's a bubble and what's a boom, as well as what cheap money is. So starting with fundamentals, Eileen, you had a couple of questions about this. What was it that you wanted to know?
Yeah, so in the Guardian article, it mentions that there's a housing bubble might be defined as a market where rising prices are not justified by the fundamentals. And I just wanted to understand what property fundamentals are and how this relates to the aforementioned housing bubble.
Yep. Thanks, Eileen. Damien, I will throw that over to you, but before I get into it, I guess I just wanted to highlight that for me, I've worked probably over 10 years now in investments in various forms, and seeing investment teams and how they do their process. When they do fundamental analysis, they're often looking at what is the fundamental value of an asset versus what is the price that it's currently trading at. If the fundamental value is more than that price, then they'll be looking to buy it and realize the valuation gain, and vice versa, look to sell it if that's the opposite. So I just put that in there before you kick off, Damien.
Yeah, sure. And I think it's worth noting, I mean, I won't go too deep into this because we want to sort of try and keep this relatively high level, but yeah, there's property fundamentals and there's investment fundamentals, and they're not the same. Mm-hmm. If you speak to somebody who's in the property market about the fundamentals, they'll be talking about, okay, how much demand is there? How much do I think I can sell this property for? And that's what they think of as fundamentals. From an investment perspective, we think about fundamentals as being, what's the actual cash flow this is generating? How volatile is that cash flow? And how sustainable is it? And what type of growth will I get from it? And so, in effect, for a house, it's the rental stream you can get from it. Whereas I think if you speak to a property property analysts themselves, it'll be about saying, okay, what's the location? Is anyone building something nearby? Is there, like, there's lots of individual ones, but as a property market as a whole, you know, not every house can be in the perfect location. You know, by definition, there are some houses in better locations and some in worse. As a property market as a whole, we sort of look and say, what are the cash flows being generated from that property, from the property market? And then within any market, even if you've got a terrible market, there'll still be some properties that will do well and some will do badly in good markets as well.
Okay, so on the slide here, we have basically you've identified two ways that you can value residential property. Mm. One is as that investment class, and then the second one, which is a dwelling, which you highlighted both of those points in what you just said there. Mm. And so if I try and separate those out into those two categories, when you're talking about what cash flows is the asset going to generate, then you're talking about thinking about it more as an investment asset. That's similar yes. to shares that you think about when you're doing the analysis at Nucleus Wealth, trying to work out what they're worth, right?
Yep, absolutely.
And then when you're talking about dwellings or valuing things on dwellings, you're talking about what's the location and all those factors that people often talk about when they're buying to live in.
Yeah, but I think it's also what are the relative costs. So everyone has to live somewhere, and the question is for people who are saying, okay, you know, you can either rent or you can buy. And so for somebody who's making that decision, which will flow, you know, and that decision's made millions of times right across the entire economy, is that we look upon it as saying, well, if the cost to rent a place versus the cost to buy a versus to buy a place and pay the mortgage is sort of a similar level or it's cheaper to have the mortgage, you'll find more people buying houses. And at the other side, end of the spectrum, if it gets expensive, then the reverse happens. People start saying, well, yes, I'd like to buy, but actually I can rent for half the price of buying, so I may as well just keep renting. And so that's one side of it.
So that's a lifestyle decision, maybe, if we're trying to put these under broad categories.
Yeah, probably.
Or a
probably
life
say
choice.
Yeah, as a relative, well, you're making it's more of a relative cost decision about saying, okay, you know, can I, if it's going to cost me $2,000 a month in interest costs versus costing me $1,000 a month to rent a place, well, okay, I've got to work out how much do I really want that house, and more people will decide just to rent. Whereas if it's okay, it's $1,000 to rent or $1,000 to pay a mortgage, then more people will decide, okay, I'll actually get a mortgage and pay it. So that's one side of it. The other side is the wage growth side. So and in terms of wage growth, is people, they can only afford a certain amount. You know, if every house in Australia was priced at $20,000 per month, all of a sudden there's a lot of homeless people because they just literally cannot. I'm not making $20,000 a month, and so therefore I cannot live in that. You live anywhere.
Okay.
And so there's that sort of push-pull dynamic. So so we look very much at rents and how fast rents are going to grow with those two lenses, is basically saying, well, if mortgage costs start going up, well, maybe rents can afford to rise a little bit more. And if people's wages are increasing a lot, then rents can go up. At the moment, that's not the case though. Inflation is very, very low. Real wage growth and nominal wage growth is very, very low. Rental growth is negative. And so on all those fronts, it doesn't look as if the fundamentals are improving. So if you're just looking at the rental stream you can get from buying a house and renting it out, that doesn't look good. The flip side is getting a mortgage has never been cheaper, and it can get even cheaper again. So we've seen from other countries around the world that you can get interest rates, you know, central banks can start actually paying banks to lend money, which is what's happening overseas. It's in Australia, the banks, the central bank, called the Reserve Bank of Australia, is lending to banks at 0.1% in order to get more mortgages out there. And so banks.
So the banks borrow it at 0.1%, and then they lend it out to like
people
me at 3%.
Yeah, well,
if I want a bad mortgage.
Yeah, there's a lot coming out at below 2%, and that's why as well at the moment they're doing it on a 3-year basis, and so that's why you see all the 3-year loans at the moment are very, very cheap, whereas you go back to standard variable rates and things like that, and it's actually quite expensive still. So because it. There's various issues with funding, but the 3-year rates you see in the market at the moment are very, very cheap, and that's where if you're getting a mortgage, you'll be able to find the best deals at the moment, because the Reserve Bank is effectively giving banks money almost for free.
Yeah. Yep.
And the flip side is overseas, the central banks are actually paying banks. So if the banks go out and lend you money, so they give Shelley a mortgage, so say she's in Germany, Shelley's paying 0.5% in interest. The bank is actually then going, the central bank is actually paying to the bank that lent Shelley another 1%. So double, they're taking whatever Shelley pays to the bank, doubling the money and giving it to the bank to help them with their profitability.
So the bank's making 1.5%, 1% from the central bank, 50 basis points from me.
Exactly.
What's going to happen after 3 years? Is that rate going to increase?
Well, that's the key. Look, I think the issue in Australia is the debts are so large that they can't increase the rates. Too much. If you start getting economic growth and things going along, then rates will start to get higher. But at the moment, we've built ourselves this debt trap where we've got so much debt out there that if the banks, Australia's got sort of the second leading household debt in the world. So if they tried to raise rates by 1%, all of a sudden a huge swath of the economy goes, just mean I can't afford to pay my mortgage at 1%, and they all have to cut back on their spending, and then that sends the economy down, and so then they have to cut rates again. So yeah, we're expecting any rate rises to be very, very minor and take a long, long time. And central banks, the Reserve Bank of Australia has spoken about keeping rates low for an extended period of time. And we just think it's going to be very difficult with the amount of debt that Australia has for them to raise rates very quickly at all.
So is underlying that assumption, or underlying that opinion, the assumption that wages are going to be pretty flat for an extended period of time? Because obviously wages increase, that increases people's ability to
pay. Yeah. So what they really need is inflation to get people's wages up, wage inflation to get people's wages higher so that people can afford higher mortgages. The issue is they've been fighting for 10 years. Mm-hmm. So even before the coronavirus hit, they just could not get wage inflation. And rental growth's been very poor. So it's really all about interest rates now. If you think that, it's almost that part of if the economy is sort of quite bad but not terrible, then it's positive for house prices because they'll keep cutting interest rates to try and spark some more growth. It's sort of the problem for house markets is actually if things get too bad or if things get too good. Because if things get too good and they start raising interest rates, then you won't get the rental growth, but you will see what people can afford will shrink, and so trouble for house prices.
Before we jump off this slide, because I feel like you've covered it pretty well so far, I don't know if you have any further questions, Eileen, but I just want to go back to point 1A, 1 and 2 there, gross yield and discounted cash flows. Can we just maybe give us a bit of a definition or explanation of what those two are in terms of valuing assets.
So your gross yield is the one that gets quoted most often in terms of looking at property, which is literally just how much do I get in rent versus how much you pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is if I'm buying a dividend in a share, that's pretty good. Or if I've got interest in the bank, that's a pretty good measure of what I'm actually getting because my costs are almost zero. The issue in the property market is your gross rent is not what you actually get. That's before you've paid any of your costs. That's before if you need to fix things in the house, if you've got to pay your landlord's insurance, council rate, you've got to pay your
real estate agent
all those types of things. So those costs are quite significant. They can be at least at least 1% and quite often even higher, closer to 2 or 3%. And so And as well, the thing you miss in property is your property is depreciating every day. So the actual the land price might not be, but your kitchen's depreciating, your carpets are depreciating, all these other things are depreciating, but you don't see that as cash flow.
Until you do.
Because most people don't do the
accrual-based accounting. Yep.
No, that's right. So what happens is, in a way, one of the great benefits of property is, from a cash flow perspective, is you get to buy it and you've got all these costs ticking away in the background that you don't see.
Yeah.
And so, maybe it's costing you a couple of grand a year in that depreciation of, but you don't see that because you don't spend it until 10 years later and all of a sudden I need to spend 20 grand to replace the kitchen. And so it's those types of costs that, if you're replacing your kitchen once every 10 years and it's costing you 20 grand, that's 2 grand a year that you are losing, but you won't see that. And so because you don't see it, it feels really good.
Yeah.
I'm getting this cash extra 2 grand every year until one day you have to pay it all back. Mm.
Okay. And discounted cash flow, they're basically the same idea is what is the cash that you're going to get on your property? Because Or your investment. I mean, I know that when I was an analyst, we did discounted cash flows to do valuation of shares. And it was just this idea of, okay, you're going to pay $5 for the share. What sort of cash flows are you going to get in return for that? So it's the same idea.
It is. The complicating factor for property is debt. And that's why people love property. A lot of people love properties because you can borrow
so much,
truckloads of money on this thing. And really leverage up your return. So, and the issue with debt is it cuts both ways. If property prices go up, then you win big time. Mm-hmm. If property prices go down, you lose big time. And so, the issue in a discounted cash flow is it all comes down to your debt assumptions and other factors like that. And so, I guess it's a.
And it can move it a lot, right?
Yeah, like within a discounted cash flow, the main thing you're looking at doing is what's called a risk premium. And saying how much risk is within this. So I need to, if I can get a $5 cash flow every year with no risk, then that's way better than if I've got a $5 cash flow that could turn into zero or negative five. And so property's got that issue of it can turn into a negative number that you have to go and spend money on this property before you can sell it or before you can get a new tenant in or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so, and then when you start adding leverage to that, all of a sudden it turns into this much bigger issue. So people tend not to use DCFs to value properties, but if you do sort of look at the analysis, the biggest assumption you've got to make is how much debt you've got on it. So properties will look good if you don't have debt, generally.
Yeah,
is that because they are quite stable in terms of the earnings? But if you're getting, say, a typical property, you might be renting it out for $25,000 a year, for example. So you're getting to $25,000 a year, it might be $26,000, it might be $22,000. You know, that doesn't really make much difference. And it makes a bit of difference, but the swings aren't that big.
Yep.
Except if you have a mortgage where you're paying $25,000 in interest, now all of a sudden it becomes, okay, I either made a couple of grand this year or I actually had to spend more money. I had to take money out of my own pocket and put it into this investment that I have. And so that's where it becomes a discounted cash flow. You know, the maths all of a sudden
just doesn't handle as well.
Well, the maths don't add up very quickly.
Okay.
And that's what property very much for now is not about the cash flows. It's about it's all about capital growth.
Mm.
And so, really you shouldn't expect rental growth, for the whole market, you should expect very low rental growth.
Yep.
And now it's just all about interest rates. If they keep cutting interest rates, you can probably get some more property growth. If they don't, then and if they raise rates, so basically the ironic thing, if things get better and they start raising rates, that's a problem for property. So,
Any more questions on fundamentals?
All good.
Let's move on to what's a bubble? What's a boom?
Yeah, so I think the main thing to think about from a bubble and a boom is a boom's when fundamentals are improving. So if you're seeing rental growth and quite strong rental growth, then that's a boom because it's justified by underlying fundamentals of it. The bubble comes when the fundamentals aren't improving but the price goes up. And so and the confusing thing though is quite often they'll happen together, and it's about trying to separate the two. So you might see fundamentals improve by 10 or 20%, but if prices double over that same period, okay, maybe I've got a bubble now. Whereas, other times you'll say, okay, well, fundamentals might be going backwards and house prices went up 20%. Okay, that's a bubble. But if fundamentals got better by 20% and house prices went up by 20%, then now we're in a boom. You can see the justification for it.
Does it matter? Sometimes you can see a lot of angst within the media trying to, split hairs over whether or not we call it one or the other. I don't know. I mean, they're pretty different definitions, obviously, but.
I think the big issue comes as to how the bubbles return to reality.
Okay.
So in the early 2000s, we saw house prices run up a lot in Sydney and then just go sideways for years and years and years. And that's pretty, a pretty harmless unwinding of a bubble. So you have the prices shoot up and then the fundamentals, and then the prices don't go anywhere for years and the fundamentals just get better and better and better. And eventually you say, okay, now we're actually back to a point where it's reasonable value. The problems come though more in when you see the big unwinds you might see in Ireland or the US or Spain during these, the housing bubble back in
08, 09.
Yeah, 08, 09. And so then that's where you get the unruly unwind. And usually that's because of forced selling. So, there's a once you get some forced selling. The issue is we put in all these processes and this time around so that people wouldn't have to force sell. You didn't have to pay your mortgage. Mm. You didn't get kicked out if you couldn't pay your rent. Like, there was a lot of policies put in, and chances are they're going to stay in. Yep. I think that article spoke about how New Zealand's trying to get house prices down.
Yeah.
The Australian government wants to get house prices up, so they're not interested in.
Why do they want to get them up?
Because I think it's a sign of a strong economy. A few years ago, somebody wrote a paper basically talking about how when house prices go up, then people go out and spend some of the money. And that sort of became a bit of a doctrine in Australia, is that that's a good thing. So if the house prices go up, they go out and borrow some more money and go buy flat screen TVs, and they go, that's a great thing for the economy.
Do you think that's an illusion or?
Absolutely, yep. An illusion, yeah. I mean, I think that the main thing for me is we don't want high house prices and property prices generally. The lower we can have property prices, the better, because you know, we don't want people, if people's sole goal in life is to buy a bunch of investment properties and rent them out to other people, it's not a particularly productive use of anyone's resources. Mm-hmm. Whereas if rents were lower and property costs were generally lower, then you'd see more people starting new companies and see more people starting actually innovative things that would actually help improve people's lives, as opposed to saying, you know, I'm going to go out and you know, buy a place, put a fresh coat of paint on it, and then sell it for $100,000 more. And you're like, how much value have added to the economy? And you're like, well, nothing.
Yeah, literally nothing.
All you've done is make somebody else pay more money. So as a society, you know, it doesn't help anyone. As individuals certainly benefit from it. Yeah. But as a society, you're better off having lower rent costs so that people can afford to go and start new businesses or go and do innovative things.
Yep. Mm. All right. How do you feel like that? Has that clarified a bubble for you?
Yeah, it definitely has. And I was just wondering, in the article it mentioned that it would endanger the economy. You mentioned the forced selling. Is there any other dangers that we need to look out for?
So I spoke about the problems of having high prices. Yeah, the problem with property bubbles is when they unwind quickly. So that's usually you get unemployment and then forced selling, mm-hmm. and you don't tend to need very much of it, you know, only a few percent, and house prices tend to take a really big tumble. As I said, in Australia, I think the government is, and the central banks and APRA and everyone sort of all about saying, like we had a Royal Commission a few years ago saying, there's all this irresponsible lending and people shouldn't be doing irresponsible lending, and they're trying to make it easier to do irresponsible lending now. So, the political complex is set up to try and pump as much debt as possible. So we think on that basis, without a big external shock and a really big external shock, you're just going to see more of the same, more policies designed to try and push house prices higher.
But don't you think the riskier that lending is, the smaller the external shock has to be that sets it off?
Absolutely.
So it's like, you know, going back 20 or 30 years, it had to be a really big shock, but now it doesn't have to be that big. And admittedly, in COVID, we saw all of these suspensions of the mechanisms that would normally come into play, which could happen again, but...
Yep. See, Hyman Minsky is basically, stability breeds instability. So basically, if you try and do this, what will happen is people will now take out bigger and bigger mortgages, because they'll say, oh, the government's got my back, I'll just take out a bigger mortgage. And then they'll keep going until the mortgages get so big that it only takes a small shock to trigger it.
Trigger all the dominoes.
Yeah, but it does appear to me that at the moment we're still in the grow bigger Ponzi's, stage of it. And as it, you've got a central bank, you've got regulators, you've got the government, everyone wants to get house prices higher.
Rightio. Well, that sounds good if you own a property.
Yeah.
Not so good if you don't. But we'll see, I guess, how this plays out. Okay, so the last slide I had here was about cheap money. So I think the article refers to us being in an era or a phase of cheap money. And I think it's a term that is used quite a lot. So, Damien, I was just wondering if you could talk us through, what is cheap money?
So basically it's your home loan rate, really, when it comes down to it. Mm-hmm. And that's that part I was talking about, that it used to be the RBA cash rate was what people spoke about for years as being, this is the thing you should be focusing on, and that's what drives mortgage rates.
And what's the RBA cash rate?
So that's how much the RBA will lend to banks at. And so, and they try and they basically try and keep the short-term lending at that level. And so that's now hit zero. But that's for us, that's not the important thing anymore. It's now the what's called the term funding facility, and that's what the central bank will lend to banks at. So central bank doesn't ordinarily lend to banks. Banks used to have to go and get their own money. But now
overnight, hang on, the cash rate, didn't they that used to?
Yeah, but let's go.
Okay,
I think it's too deep for
Yeah, no worries.
The key bit is ordinarily banks have to go and raise their own money. So that's what think of that as a government rate. Mm-hmm. Banks have to go out and lend their own money. Now the issue is the central bank is trying to make it cheaper for banks to provide mortgages, so that the central bank is literally printing dollars, giving it to banks in order that they go out and give away cheap mortgages. And so that is now the most important thing. Same thing happened in Europe. They started at about 0.5%, and now they're at negative 1%. Australia started at close to 0.5%. Now we're down to 0.1. If things get any worse, we'll go negative as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. So banks, before the central bank started lending them money, they used to use deposits. So from all of their customers, and then they would package that up and lend it to mortgage people to get a mortgage. And then in Australia, we didn't have enough deposits, so they would go overseas and try to borrow money from other people overseas to set up those mortgages. So it is a huge change what the central bank, the RBA, have done here.
Yeah, so banks will still try and do a little bit around that around the edges, but yeah, I think about half the lending's coming from...
That's a lot.
Yeah, so it's a... we're in a government-driven, government-sponsored situation.
Yeah.
I may have a question that's a little off topic, but if you're seeing a lot of people, especially millennials now, going to invest in the stock market themselves, how do you see that affect the governments with asking for money from their clients? And do you think that the RBS rates are going to increase?
I think it's for rates to increase, it's all about wage growth. And you don't tend to get wage growth just from making investments. So, you know, ironically, rather than having millennials go out and invest, what they actually want millennials to do is go out and buy more coffees and have more haircuts and, you know, get more massages and that type of stuff. It's actually more about saying the bigger demand we can have for services, the more we can force the unemployment rate down. Now companies actually have to start paying more for their staff. And pushing the wage growth.
Rates can follow that.
Yeah, all about wage growth at the moment. So more investment is actually a bad thing, and that's part of the problem is we've got this inequality where the richer people get more money, and so they just save it or they invest it. Poorer people, when they get more money, they tend to spend it straight away, and we've been giving more money to the richer people and less to the poorer people. So that means just more and more investment and not enough actual spending.
I don't know what to do with Sai. Okay. So have you got any more questions for Damien?
Not at the moment. Thank you so much, Damien.
Hey, no problems.
Maybe before I wrap up, do you want to give us I think you've alluded to it throughout the show, but the 1 minute wrap up on your outlook for the property market in Australia?
Should we buy now or wait?
Yeah. Look, so it is government supported. It's all about what government's doing and their plans for the property market. I think the current government, all their plans are about trying to push it higher and try and pour more mortgage money into people to get people to borrow more and go out and buy houses. That's a dangerous longer term scenario, but in the short term, it works very well for house prices. There's an election coming up in about a year. The Labor Party, after trying to take some housing, sort of positive housing price, so trying to, policies that would help improve affordability last time are unlikely to do anything. I think they're just going to try and have as small a target as possible. So they'll be less positive for house prices, but they're not negative. They're not going to try and do, certainly not at the moment, talking about anything like what's happening in New Zealand, where they're actually saying, no, we don't want house prices to run riot. Mm-hmm. We'd actually like lower house prices. So, I guess the thing I would keep coming back to is saying it's a lifestyle decision for a lot of people. Think about it from that perspective first. As an investment decision, look, there's probably a short-term trade in it, but you need to make a lot of money because your entry and exit costs are so high. You probably need to make at least 10% just to get around your entry and exit costs. And so
it's like stamp duty and then the commission to the real estate agent.
Yes, plus there's a whole bunch of other costs to go with it. All on our property calculator, you can have a look at
that. Yeah, okay, great.
And that'll sort of show
so
you
those we'll ones. Put the link up for that.
Yeah, but the net effect is if you're looking at, say, over a two-year period, you need to be pretty convinced you're going to make 10-15%, which is a tall order and the issue is if you're going to borrow a lot of money, you know, you put down $50,000 on a $500,000 house, then that thing moves up 10%, you've doubled your 50,000. It moves down 10%, you've actually wiped out your entire
investment.
Yeah. And then and you've got all those extra costs on top. And the other thing to remember as well is that the apartment market has not been going as well as the housing market. So it's actually all about land values. It's actually not about the value of the building. It's actually about the value of the land that's going up, not the value of the buildings.
Thank you. Thanks both of you, Eileen and Damien, for joining me for today's episode. And thanks to you listening. If you have any feedback for me about this episode or any ideas for future podcast topics, please let me know in the YouTube comments or send me an email at contact@nucleuswealth.com. And a few quick notes. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. And to stay up to date with news from Nucleus Wealth, you can follow us on social media or subscribe to our newsletters via our homepage. And finally, if you know anyone who gets something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share it with a friend, and help our show grow. And thanks again for tuning in for myself and the team. We look forward to catching you next time.